Hey guys, this is Josh Hinken of Ultimate Sandbag Core Training Systems, and today I have a really special guest, a guy I've been super psyched about interviewing and just have heard wonderful things about, Mr. Rob Wolf. Rob, how are you today?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And for those of you that aren't familiar with Rob, he's really got some impressive accomplishments and credentials here. Let me just tell you a little bit about Rob. Rob is a strength and conditioning coach at Strength and Conditioning. He's been an athlete as well. He's won the National Athlete Strength Association California State Powerlifting Championship at the age of 19 and holds an undefeated amateur kickboxing record. Rob professionally is an NSCA strength conditioning certified specialist and a USAW Olympic weightlifting coach. And probably surprisingly, some people, he's a CrossFit coach, which is the highest level of CrossFit training certification. So Rob's been in CrossFit for probably longer than most people have. So he's got some really interesting and unique perspectives. And Rob, you know, I think one of the really cool things too is that you have a degree from Cal State University, Chico, where you earned your BS in biochemistry. And that's really giving you some unique perspectives upon things like metabolism and nutrition. So, Rob, you know, how do you do a better introduction than that? Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm stoked to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, Rob, tell us a little bit about what you have coming up with your paleo solution. I think there's a really a lot of confusion for a lot of people upon what makes a paleo versus, let's say, low-carb Atkins type of diets.
Oh, shoot. You know, for me, this paleo perspective is just trying to look towards some of the information that we could get from anthropology, from modern genetics and biochemistry research, and find some ideas for how to steer our lives in a more healthy or productive manner. And I guess from the paleo perspective, you know, versus, say, like a classic kind of Atkins sort of scenario, Atkins was generally kind of low carb across the board, maybe not real focused on food quality like protein source, grass-fed versus grain-fed, artificial sweeteners and stuff like that, whereas the paleo perspective is really putting a premium on quality food. And so we're looking at ideally grass-fed or well-caught protein sources. It's not a do-or-die thing, but it's just like if you're trying to optimize your situation, that's kind of the place that you would look. Lots of seasonal fruits and vegetables. Fruits used more as an on-need basis, generally to replenish muscle glycogen after hard training. And then good fats rounded out with like fish oil, avocado, olive oil, and that sort of stuff. So for me, the paleo perspective is very much a potent emphasis on food quality first, and then kind of letting proportionality play itself out on an as-needed and individualistic basis.
You know, Rob, you just said a whole bunch of really interesting things, and that's why I'm excited to have you today. And, you know, one thing that stands out to me, at least right off the bat, is, you know, you're talking about the anthropology. And now I've heard about, you know, paleo-type eating in the past, and I've always had the question and the intrigue. You know, it seems to be in our world, there's so many different cultures, and it would seem like our evolution would have been so different. You know, sort of, have you found any commonalities that sort of has gone across the different cultures? You know, obviously, if you're in Africa versus Asia, you're going to see quite a distinct different metabolism and maybe accessibility to food.
Well, you know, the interesting thing with that is that the global distribution that we see right now, genetically, it's actually rather limited in the amount of variety that you would see. And this gets a little bit esoteric. I don't know if this is going to, like, lose folks. But if we were to look at a family group of, say, like chimpanzees, and we were to use a microarray and map the genetics of this family group of chimpanzees, there's greater variability in the genetics of that one chimpanzee group than there is in the totality of humans. And nobody usually gets put out when we say a chimpanzee should eat like leaves and fruit, and it does a little bit of hunting of smaller critters and stuff like that. But people get very up in arms when we start talking about like what the ancestral diet of humans look like, because all of our perspective is based on, you know, essentially agriculture forward, which is our demarcation of like recorded history. All of this history that happened for several million years before agriculture just kind of disappears from our consciousness. So there are some metabolic changes, you know, like some people out of pastoralist backgrounds, they can handle say, like the lactose out of dairy better than other people, and there are a few little tweaks and changes, but by and large, we are much more similar than we are dissimilar. And with that in mind, then when we start looking at some of the reconstructed Paleolithic diets that people like Professor Cordain, Boyd Eaton, Stefan Lindbergh have kind of put back together, then what we see is a preponderance of lean proteins from wild free-ranging animals, seafood, seasonal fruits and vegetables, roots and tubers, and we just see a remarkable dearth or lack of grains, legumes, and dairy. And when we can use that as a model, and then when we get in and start experimentally starting to play with some of this stuff, we finally are starting to see some legit, solid clinical trials in which, say, they compare a group of mixed ethnicity folks who have type 2 diabetes eating what would be a representative paleo-type diet, so meat, fruit, vegetables, good fats, versus a Mediterranean-type diet, which would be characterized by low-fat dairy, low-fat protein sources, whole grains, and legumes. This is a studied clinical trial performed by Stefan Lindbergh. And what they found was that the type 2 diabetics on this paleo diet, at the end of the 8-week trial, they were clinically no longer type 2 diabetic, whereas the grain-based diet, this much vaunted Mediterranean-type diet, the folks were still type 2 diabetic. They still had metabolic derangement. They still had signs and symptoms of systemic inflammation. And so it's that food quality perspective that really does matter. And it kind of blows people out of the water because they just want to say, well, a carb is a carb and stuff like that. But the reality is that there's a lot more depth to this story than what I think any of us would really like to have it, the real story be. Obviously it'd be great if it was a much more simpler process, but it's actually fairly complex.
Well, now it seems only really complex because, I've a few months ago when I went to Europe, we watched the documentary Food Inc. And for anyone that hasn't seen that, that's incredibly disturbing, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But it really sort of, echoes what you're saying. And, people watch that and really see how our food sources have changed. I think they get a better understanding of really what you're saying. But, you're also a strength coach, so you work with people trying to get them to adhere to these plans. What are some of the initial challenges that you really find that people have when they're trying to switch to more a paleo diet plan?
It kind of varies. Like at this point, because of the success that our gym has seen, on a local level, we have some pretty good cachet that we get really good results, and people understand that we're pretty hardcore on the nutrition. And so the buy-in is pretty good at this point. Like early on, people faced a lot of problems with just not wanting to give up refined, like cookies and bread and stuff like that. But we do actually kind of a hard sell, soft sell. The hard sell being we show examples of the success that people have had in the gym, body composition changes, performance improvement, reversal of certain autoimmune diseases, like some really, really big stuff in that regard. So that's kind of the hard sell that we show folks that, this can definitely succeed. And then the soft sell is that we just kind of beg them, almost hump their knee for them to just give us 30 days. Give us 30 days, give us full compliance, and then you assess, was it worthwhile? Were the result, because it's a legitimate question. Maybe for some people this is too austere of an intervention. Maybe it's too disruptive to their lifestyle. Maybe it's just not a good fit for them. And I think that trying to make this not a religion, not turn it into zealotry and whatnot, then we should be able to step back and just ask a simple question: is this worthwhile for the folks doing it? And what we find is that by and large, people are like, yeah, this is definitely worthwhile. And one of the big delineation points that we get, people usually buy in pretty strongly for a couple of months, and then they start getting a little more latitude with their food. And the one thing that we just really beg people that they do is kind of remain gluten-free. So like wheat, rye, oats, barley, millet, the gluten-containing grains seem to be particularly problematic from an inflammation and a gut irritation standpoint. And so what we encourage people to do is, kind of Monday through Friday, eat their meat, their fruit, their veggies, their roots, tubers, good fats, And then kind of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, they get a little more latitude with the program. And what we encourage them to go for are things like corn tortillas, beans, rice, and things like that. If they're going to kick their heels up and do something different, we try to steer them towards non-gluten-containing items. So if they want a dessert, instead of doing like cookies or cake, then we encourage like dark chocolate-covered almonds or something like that. That's just generally a better food quality and then also is gluten-free. And we get really good long-term success with that.
Well, and that makes me think of a couple of things. One thing I'll get to definitely is, because I'm definitely a big believer in the gluten aspect, having a personal experience with that. But, you know, do you find people that can – I know this may sound kind of funny, but can they sort of do paleo and get any benefit, or is it sort of a program where if you're going to do it, you might as well do it right and really get the whole benefit?
You know, there's always I think there's a graded buy-in that any movement this direction is a big improvement. You know, for a number of our folks that we work with, initially just getting them to stop drinking soda is like our first thing. So, you know, and it's like, and we may spend a couple of weeks just simply getting soda and other liquid sugars out of their rotation. And that is a remarkably big step down the right path, but they may
Absolutely.
Still be doing tons of bread and rice and pasta and everything. But then in a graded fashion, then we'll start going after some of the more refined carbs. So any direction that you move towards some qualitative food choices is obviously going to be a huge step. But then there reaches kind of an inflection point, and it really depends on whether or not people have an autoimmune condition or some really serious systemic inflammation. And if they have some of these more serious problems, we need a really a pretty severe intervention or, you know, some strong commitment initially. And if we can get that, we get 4 to 6 weeks of really solid compliance, grain-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, the whole mix, then we get a stunning transformation, and then the person has a little bit more latitude on the back end. It buys them a little bit more latitude with what they can get away with and not suffer some really bad effects. So there's definitely a graded buy-in. Like, it doesn't have to be an all-or-nothing thing in general, but there are some people that it's kind of like, you know, if you want to get better, if you've got lupus,
right,
rheumatoid arthritis, or some really serious weight issues that lead into inflammation, then it's kind of like, let's be aggressive on this and really turn the Titanic, because it's heading towards that iceberg.
Sure, anytime someone makes a significant change in their life, they sort of have to take the proactive role themselves, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. And, the people that we see who succeed on this, they go home, they gut their house, they get rid of all the junk. There's no junk at home. If they want to have something that's off rails, then they go out to eat and they have it and then it's done. Like, we just are not wired up for self-control with this stuff. And so the people who have really good success, they just kind of control their home environment. Work and school and other obligations can be kind of challenging because, ironically, you know, the people around us will almost actively try to undermine our efforts with this stuff. And so you have to really plan ahead so that you can deal with these kind of odd contingencies, like showing up at a family reunion or a work party or something like that. You definitely need to plan ahead a little.
Yeah, it's so funny because when you start, you know, someone gets on a program. I've had clients like this, I'm sure you have too, where, you know, they get on the program and then they start getting with family members go, no, you should be doing this diet better. It's not as crazy. It's not as nuts as what you're doing, and it'll still work. You know, I'm sure you've gone through that as well, huh?
Yeah, the family members can be kind of wacky. Like, well, we've had a number of situations, either a husband or a wife training with us, and the individual will start losing a lot of weight, start feeling good, and then the other spouse will not really like the change because all of a sudden this kind of new, confident person, oftentimes a person very, very different than who they married, starts emerging out of the process. And it can get a little dodgy at some point, how that can play out. But you know, when one person starts changing their nutrition, obviously it affects a ton of people, you know, depending on how large their social network is.
Well, back to one of the things I'm most interested about, which was your mention of the gluten intolerance. And, you know, there's, I think, you know, for myself, I'm a full believer, you know, having had some issues myself, you know, when I eat anything gluten based, it goes haywire, both with performance and cosmetic side. But for a lot of people, they don't even know or are aware that they're gluten tolerant. And some people that are aware of the type of problems that may exist with gluten, they're pretty assertive in saying, well, they don't have a problem with it. You know, can you go into a little deeper detail about, you know, can you sort of self-diagnose a little bit if you are have a tolerance problem? And for those that say, you know, no way, can I have a problem, you know, what may they be missing out?
Well, you know, unless somebody has really done a full removal of these foods for a good 3 to 4 weeks, then you really don't know what your baseline tolerance is. Like for me, I'm super sensitive to gluten. So like when I travel, if I just order a steak or a piece of chicken or something, and that meat is grilled on a grill that they grilled a grilled cheese sandwich on that grill, say like earlier in the day, I actually get sick from that. Like I'll have some GI problems. And I'm super sensitive to that. Whereas my wife, she wouldn't have a problem with that, but she would have a problem if she had like a cookie or a piece of bread. Like she would get some bloating and some discomfort from that. And I definitely noticed like some performance problems. I get weak, a lot of lethargy, foggy headed and all that sort of stuff. So there definitely is a spectrum with this, but what I've found, you know, now, you know, like 10 years down the road, having worked with people on these topics, it is super rare that I find someone who pulls these foods out of the rotation, that they don't feel better with the substitution of things like yams, sweet potatoes, seasonal fruit, and that sort of stuff. Typically, they get leaner. Typically, they gain some muscle. Typically, they have better performance. And then with the introduction of the grains, legumes, dairy, but, you know, but particularly these gluten-containing items, they don't look, feel, and perform as well. And so it's very, very quantifiable, but you need a period of time with a removal of these foods so that the gut lining can actually heal. It takes about 2 weeks for the gut lining to heal. And then when that layer of inflammation that's been going on in our digestive tract is dealt with, instead of dealing with what's essentially like a low-grade infection, you know, low-grade inflammation going on, when that is removed, then our body's resources are free to be reallocated into other things, like recovering from exercise or working on a business project or something like that. So that's where people feel so much better, feel so much more energetic when they remove the gluten or similar inflammatory or gut-irritating foods out of the rotation, because their body is just, it's not fighting itself any longer. But you do need a period of time without these foods in the rotation. I've legitimately seen a couple of people, these guys were both Navy SEALs, who, like, they would eat paleo, like dot the I, cross the T, paleo, and they'd perform great, and then they would go out and drink a bunch of Guinness and eat bread, and, like, it really did not affect these guys. But I swear they're like a Wolverine. Like you could drop them off a building and like they would just pick themselves up, put their elbow back in socket and like go. Like they're really wired up, pretty robust and tough. And it's just rare that I see that. And one of these guys caught a really nasty gut bug in Afghanistan. And after that, he has noticed that he's much more sensitive to gluten. Like he's like, man, I really notice it now, because he ended up losing almost 30 pounds from a pretty nasty gut bug.
Wow.
And so different people, different stages of their life, say like you're caretaking a parent who's dying, or you have a new baby arrive and your sleep gets impacted. These other peripheral stressors can be huge influences or vectors in how you respond to your dietary stuff. So say like you're cruising along and your oatmeal and Ezekiel bread really isn't causing you a problem, but then you know, your wife gives birth to a baby girl or something and you lose a bunch of sleep and then you get sick. At the end of that whole process, you may be in a position in which you are more sensitive to the gluten. And we definitely see that stuff happen. And this is kind of normal propagation, like in the epidemiological literature. You see processes like this when people develop multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, like they'll have a big life event, they'll get really run down, severely impacted, and then they may end up developing some sort of an autoimmune condition. So it can stem from a lot of different areas.
So for people that might be a little unfamiliar, I know my wife, when I met her, you know, even though she's a physical therapist, was really surprised when I would say these things to her, and she would say to me all the time, Now, how could that be bad? You know, they promote wheat bread as having fiber and nutritious. You know, how do you explain to people sort of the difference between the food industry and what you're finding to be true?
Well, I mean, you can tackle this on a couple of different levels. You know, you can get real hardcore on the science and start looking at, like, some of the autoimmune and, health implications of the grains, you know, looking at lectins, anti-nutrients, protease inhibitors and stuff like that that kind of mess with digestion. A real nice thing to use on medical professionals is something that Lauren Cordain did in both his book and some of his early papers, which is simply comparing 2,000 calories of paleo-type foods like lean meats, seafood, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, and then comparing that and seeing if you can even construct a 2,000-calorie diet, or if you put together a 2,000-calorie diet of whole grains, legumes, low-fat dairy, et cetera, and just simply compare the vitamins, minerals, antioxidants in the two programs. And the paleo diet looks as if you're taking a nutritional supplement, like you get hundreds or thousands of times the RDA of all your vitamins, minerals, et cetera, whereas the grain and legume-based diet, you don't even meet the minimum RDA on most of the stuff that you're eating. And so just on a nutrient quality standpoint, you know, calorie per calorie, dietitians love to talk about the fact that, or this idea that we need to eat fewer calories, and it's like, okay, that's cool. Well, let's eat the most nutrient-dense food we can per calorie, and if we sit and make that statement, then it boils down to lean meats, you know, wild-caught fish, fruits and vegetables, some nuts and seeds, and that's really it. And so we can tackle it on both those sides. And then the fiber thing is always kind of funny to me because, you know, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, certainly contain plenty of fiber. So it's just kind of a funny deal.
It's a funny kind of argument.
People ignore that. Yeah.
Well, and you know, you mentioned nuts a little bit. I found something interesting when I was reading some of your material that, you know, I want, maybe you could explain, you know, what's your view on nuts? Because I know a lot of people that start low carb and they start paleotype, you know, they start really loading up on nuts. You know, what's your feeling on nuts and seeds as far as their role in the whole program?
Oh, man, you know, it's funny kind of the evolution of all that stuff because originally when I started eating this way, I ate tons and tons of, almonds, walnuts, cashews, all that sort of stuff, and I did pretty well on it. But over the course of time, we started putting together the fact that these nuts, similar to grains and legumes, have some anti-nutrients in them, like phytates and lectins that can be gut irritating, but then also they tend to be really heavy in a linoleic acid, which is that short chain omega-6 fat, and our you know, modern diet is anywhere from 10 to 20 times too heavy in this omega-6 fat. Ideally, from kind of ancestral dietary patterns, we should see about a 1-to-1 omega-3 to omega-6, and ideally those come in the form of, the omega-3s coming from kind of a fish oil type source, EPA, DHA, or arachidonic acid out of the omega-6 family, and this is exactly what we would see out of seafood, out of grass-fed meat, out of pastured eggs, even if we were doing, say, like a pastured butter or something like that, grass-fed butter, we would see a nice omega-3, omega-6 ratio, and it would be the long-chain versions of both of those fats. The nuts and seeds provide typically a very large dose of the short-chain omega-6, which is a very pro-inflammatory fatty acid. It can cause some downstream problems. And, you know, that's all the theory behind it. And then putting it into some practical application, we just tell people, hey, instead of so much nuts and seeds, and we steer them towards more like coconut, which doesn't have much of the linoleic acid, avocados and some other, monounsaturated fats. And lo and behold, these people end up performing better. They get leaner. Some of the gut irritation that they were still experiencing ends up going away. And so it's one of those things that certainly nuts and seeds are, they fall under that kind of paleo category. But when you get right down to it, if people consumed nuts and seeds by basically like cracking them out of their original shell and then eating them at that pace, that would probably self-limit the nuts and seeds to a degree that would make them kind of viable in the diet. But when we've got just a Costco 5-pound bag of almonds, we can just crush so much more than what, you know, ancestrally we would have ever eaten. You know, it was eaten very much in a piecemeal manner and a slower seasonal and all that sort of stuff. So I think they're potentially good things, but we just end up overdoing them for sure.
And maybe you can enlighten us a little bit because, you know, I hear in my head already, you know, my clients that I've worked with for, you know, years upon years, whenever you change their nutrition, you know, because of, you know, what you're telling them not to eat, they instantly think there's not a lot of variety in what they can eat. So could you give an example of, like, what would Rob eat on a common day?
Well, you know, let me tackle that in a kind of an oblique way, and then I'll go after that because we get that same thing. It's like, oh, I'm bored, I don't know what to cook, and all this sort of stuff. And so I have this thing called the food matrix, and when I do the Paleolithic Solution seminars, this is kind of how I wrap up the day. I'll have the audience give me a list of different types of protein, you know, like chicken, fish, meat, lamb, turkey, you know, you name it, and we'll get 20 or so different types of protein up on board. And then I'll ask them for a list of vegetables, and we'll list the vegetables up there. And then fat, I'll get different fats. And usually we're looking at like coconut oil, olive oil, maybe some lard or butter occasionally or something like that. But I'll get 5 or 6, maybe 7 different types of cooking type fats. And then I'll ask for a list of herbs and spices. And then from there, I'll just ask the people, you know, like, are you really bored or are you just lazy? And my contention is that people are not bored. They're just damn lazy, and they've painted themselves into a corner of just being almost helpless that is pretty silly because if we have these four columns and we have, say, like 20 protein options, 20 or so vegetable options, 5 fat options, and then 20 or so spice options, which all of this is easily accessible from any supermarket anywhere. I don't care what type of backwater you live in. Like Chico is as small and backwoodsy as you could get. If we were to pick one item of the protein, one item out of the vegetables, one item from the fat, one item from the herbs and spices thing, throw it in a pan, put some heat to it, and cook it, chances are it would taste pretty good. You don't need to proportion it. Just do it. And chances are it's pretty good. And then let's say you don't see that one again. Like it's basically taking one out of each of these columns. It's kind of like a slot machine deal. You've got over 25,000 options out of that. And if you did one of these a day, you wouldn't see the same meal again for like 70 or 80 years. So when people talk about being bored or uncreative, it's just crap. You know, they're just simply being lazy. You need to just take, hunk of protein, some vegetable matter, some sort of seasoning, some sort of fat, throw it in a pan, put some heat to it, put a lid on it, set a timer, come back 5 or 10 minutes later, and if it's done cooking, then pour it in a bowl and eat it, and 9 times out of 10 it'll be great. Occasionally you'll have a dog and you'll have to toss it, but this is most of my cooking. You know, like I've got a bunch of herbs and spices up in the cabinet. We've got a variety of protein sources. I'll just grab something, throw the protein in a bowl of water to thaw it out because it's typically frozen, and then I'll cut that up, throw it in the pan, throw some vegetables in there, put some like curry powder or garlic powder or pepper or whatever I feel like doing, put the heat on, put the lid on, and so it ends up kind of braising more or less. And 10 minutes later, I've got a meal that's pretty damn good. Like it's a B+ or A- quality meal. And it takes me less than 5 to 10 minutes of total prep, probably closer to 5 minutes. It tastes good. It's healthy. It's easy. I can either make a lot or a little. And so when people start making noise about like, I don't know what to cook or I'm bored or whatever, then I do the food matrix on them. And when that's done, then it just boils down to, okay, now you understand that you are just lazy and uncreative, and you need to go in the kitchen, and that's all there is to it. And this isn't even getting into the realm of like, okay, there's, you know, the internet and recipes. You know, you could Google any recipe you want, probably 20, 30 websites that would claim to be paleo-related recipes, or you just find standard, Weight Watchers or any type of recipe thing that you find something interesting, and then tweak it to fit what your needs are. It's just not that hard. Folks just need to get back in the kitchen. They've gotten way too lazy.
Well, and it's got to be a lot of the fast food and prepared meal ideas, you see it all the time too, I'm sure, with parents, picking up their kids' fast food instead of making them dinner. It's sort of a curse that we have in a lifestyle where we have abundant bad food, huh?
Yeah, and it's subsidized and it's cheap, and that's a lot of that stuff that the Food Inc. and like King Korn and stuff like that kind of uncover, that this the cheap bad food is only cheap because it's subsidized, and then we're paying for it on the tax side of things, and it kind of hides the real cost to it. But one of our trainers, Sarah Fragoso, she has a great website, everydaypaleo.com, and she's a mother of three. They have two dogs. Her husband has a really busy ART chiropractic practice, and she went from being pretty sick and pretty overweight to a super hot, lean little milfy kind of chick.
So you're in trouble there with the wife there.
Totally. Well, we're all good friends, but the thing to take home out of this is that she's as busy as anybody that I've ever seen, but she has just committed to making this work. And so when she gets up in the morning, she throws on a crock pot and she puts some protein and some like tomato sauce over the protein and some vegetables in there and sets it cooking. And it requires a little bit of planning, but in the long run, it costs less money. It's definitely healthier for the whole family. The kids do better in school. They feel better. She looks better. She feels better. And it can be done. It just requires some shifting of priorities. And maybe you forego 20 minutes of TV the night before to go prep some food for the following day or something. But, people find it, they devote the time to the things that they find important. And if being a little healthier, being in a little bit better shape is important to you, then you allocate the time and the resources to do it. And it's really not that hard. It's not that impactful in the beginning. There may be a little bit more work up front to figure out what's going on, but then once you figure it out, it's not hard at all. It's very, very livable, very sustainable. And here again is that you have kind of an 80-20 Pareto kind of thing. Most of the time, eat more or less this way. When you're hanging out with friends or family or something like that, you want to kick your heels up, then you do some NorCal margaritas, some corn tortillas with carne asada taco type things, and go a little bit more off rails, and then get back on once you're back into your work week. So it's not austere, it's not hard, it's really not any more time consuming. It just boils down to individuals making the choice that this is what they're going to do. They have some compelling reason to do it.
And I'm on the website right now. For people who are listening, if they go to everydaypaleo.com, this is great. I mean, she lays it out really easily, and it looks like some delicious meals there. So definitely worthwhile checking out. And you made me crack up.
Yeah,
you made me crack up, Rob, because something I've always used with my clients that have sort of been stubborn about changing their planning and their preparation is, I've never known a business to be successful that didn't want to plan for it.
Right.
They couldn't just wing it. So if it goes for business and it goes for about every other attribute in life, I don't know why it doesn't go for fitness as well, huh?
Yeah, and it requires a little bit of commitment and occasionally a little sacrifice, but, not huge. But like you said, anything that's good, whether you build a business or you have a good marriage or, you have a good relationship with your kids so that they don't write true Hollywood, horror story about what a terrible parent you are and stuff. Like, all of that stuff takes work, and all of it takes just waking up each day and recommitting to, like, okay, this is what I'm up to, and I'm committed to this. And, just ultimately, though, you do need some compelling reasons on the back end for doing a lot of this stuff. And that's where the physical side of this is nice, whether you're doing dance classes or motocross or, like, just being geeked out on something physical makes the kind of nutritional side fit a little more, because you see so immediately the ups and downs related to the quality of your food. And it gives you something really quantifiable to anchor, good eating versus bad eating.
So Rob, along those lines too, with preparation and so forth, are you a believer in You know, someone has to eat 5-6 times a day, they can eat 3 times a day, or they just eat when they feel like it. What's your view on that?
You know, I definitely came from that powerlifting, bodybuilding, like eat 6 or 8 times a day kind of mindset, and now I'm at a spot where I'll range anywhere from like 1 to 3 times a day, depending on my appetite and my work output and whatnot. Like if I do a double day where I'm doing jujitsu and I'm doing a little bit of strength and conditioning later in the day, then I may eat 3 or 4 meals that day just based off of kind of appetite. And I kind of take advantage of like some post-workout carb repletion and stuff like that using yams and sweet potatoes. But then other days where I'm just hunkered in writing on my book, I may eat breakfast and that's it. And the interesting thing is that for a 38-year-old dude, like I'm you know, single-digit body fat, I've got really good strength metrics for metabolic conditioning type stuff. I'm pretty good with that. I've got good game on the mat. And that's with, like, really minimal, minding of the store in that regard. So I really have finally migrated to a spot where I don't force feed myself. I eat when I'm hungry. Occasionally, like, if I'm going to have a really big day, then I may preemptively eat because I know I'm not going to be able to eat later. But I'm not buggered by, like, missing a meal now. If I do a little intermittent fasting, that doesn't bother me. I just make sure to make up a little bit later, and it's so much easier. And that's just, you know, kind of practical application. This stuff has been studied now pretty well, and the 3-meal-a-day versus 6-meal-a-day scenario produces just as good a fat loss, just as good a muscle gain. If you have somebody who is really trying to pack on a lot of weight, then obviously you may need to eat a little more frequently just to get that amount of food down. But it's rare that I find somebody can't get by with, like, 3 good meals and a snack, you know, like if somebody's really going crazy on, like, a 20-rep squat routine and they want to get big, right, almost regardless of a food comp, then you do 3 big meals and drink a gallon of milk a day and you'll get big. You know, it's like,
yeah.
And then rest and you'll get big. So it's very easy to tailor all that stuff based on what your needs are. So I'm not a real... Definitely have changed over time, like the number of meals that we need, and definitely more on a more instinctual eating pattern at this point.
So what do you say to those people that are going to be shouting at you? Come on, Rob, the blood sugar issue, the blood sugar. How are you regulating blood sugar, you know, and insulin, and things like that?
Your body, once you get kind of fat adapted, then your liver will release enough blood sugar to keep your blood sugar sound. And then your body runs off of fat, and even if you're lean, you've got months of energy reserves from your fat mass. And if you must eat, that's actually a really good question, and this is one of those questions that I'll use with our clients and when I'm helping other trainers get good with working with the nutrition with their clients. If your folks eat a meal and then they are hungry again within an hour or 2 hours or something like that, and there was something proportionally wrong with that meal. They typically had too much carbohydrate in it. They had too much of kind of an insulin spiking effect. Or there's some lifestyle issues going on, like the person's not sleeping enough, they're overtraining or something. You should be able to go 3, 4, 5, 6 hours without eating, and you might be hungry, but you can function. Your brain doesn't just shut down and you go into a fog and, you know, you're ready to rip somebody's arm off and eat them. So...
Well, that's interesting because, you know, we've all known those people, and I've been guilty of being that type of person in the past. So you're saying that, you know, if you go, you know, the 3 or 4 hours and you're just crazy, that there's actually something else going on there. It's not just
your meal planning was poor, like the amount or the quality of carbohydrate was poor, or like your overall lifestyle stuff, there's some hole in that, like a lack of sleep can impact insulin sensitivity, overtraining can impact insulin sensitivity. Base level stress could be too high. And some of this stuff gets real hard to control. You know, like you're a new parent, you've got a kid, you're up late with them because they had a fever or something. That can be a problem. But if the following day you're like, man, I've really got a sweet tooth, then you just stick it in your head. You're like, oh, okay, my sleep's disturbed right now, so I'm not as insulin sensitive, so I need to be a little bit even more fastidious on my food unless I want to start, you know, ballooning up, gaining body fat, getting, you know, having inflammation set in on my body and stuff, which ends up making the sleep deprivation even worse. So, it just forces you to be more fastidious on your eating. Our police, mill, firefighter crowd because of their the shift work nature of what they do, they notice these sleep disturbance impacts particularly potently, and these folks comment too that, you know, tightening up the food as much as they possibly can buys them extra percentage points in the gym and on patrol and all that sort of stuff, because there's nothing that they can really do to fix the sleep because it's just woven into their schedule.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome. And Rob, we won't take up too much more of your time. Just got a couple more because this has been, I think, really informative for a lot of people. You know, one big question I think it would be interesting to get your perspective is, you know, what do you see as the most common misconceptions about the paleo diet?
Gosh, I guess the one thing is that it's just inherently low carb. Like people will immediately jump in and they'll say, oh, well, it's all, you know, it's low carb or low carb fat for you. Or even if people think that it's okay to do it, they assume that paleo eating is just like meat and veggies, but that is, it's very carb agnostic. Like it's, you know, if you are a high performing athlete, triathlete, MMA fighter, whatever, then you're going to need more dietary carbohydrate to burn in that really short duration, more explosive type activity. If you're more sedentary, then you simply don't need that stuff. But that's a real common misconception. There's some general stuff floating around out there, like paleo is high protein, and high protein will demineralize your bones or will give you kidney stones and some stuff like that. And the science on that is very, very clear that that's just not the case at all. And interestingly, it's more the case of like the high dairy, high grain type diets causing those problems. And the science is very, very clear, but folks are reticent to really look at it and really read it. And it's kind of funny, the people who are the loudest about wanting these validations or, you know, raising these questions, frequently they have such a poor scientific background that if you were to throw them a legitimate – they wouldn't know a legitimate scientific study from a poorly designed study. So that's kind of a funny deal too. But those are the biggies, you know, that paleo is inherently low carb or that – you know, high protein diets are going to somehow be damaging to you.
Oh, really good, really good. So tell us a little bit about the book that you're working your butt off trying to put out. You know, what's that going to involve, and you know, how is that going to be different than maybe some of the information already out there?
Well, it's, you know, it was an outgrowth of providing these seminars originally for CrossFit related to nutrition, and then having done my own thing and just seeing this huge need for people to have a resource, kind of a one-stop shop resource that covered everything from kind of the anthropological ideas behind the paleo diet to a mechanistic understanding of how insulin resistance happens, problems with leaky gut and the autoimmune response related to grain, legume, and dairy intolerances, how the changes in our fatty acid profile of our modern versus ancestral diets have been causing problems for us. The real cryptic problem of cortisol, overtraining, overreaching, lack of sleep, you know, basically a lifestyle that is way too crazy and hectic. There's nothing that has, like, integrated all that stuff and has looked at it from both a scientific perspective but also kind of a practical application perspective. And I've had the good fortune of working with now thousands of people from, like, every walk of life you could imagine, you know, stay-at-home moms, college professors, police, mill, firefighter, mixed martial arts athletes. And so this thing's kind of a condensation of all that information, and it covers it in pretty geeky detail, but also, you know, explaining the mechanisms of what's going on, but also makes it understandable. Anybody with, you know, eighth-grade education should be able to understand this if they want to put some time in and learn some new stuff. And so it is written for, you know, our moms, our dads, our aunts, our uncles, these people who we are trying to help them be healthier and live healthier lives, but they have a ton of questions and they don't understand, you know, there's like so much information out there, so many conflicting ideas, and this kind of cuts through all that stuff and makes a very strong scientific argument that is then backed up by this, you know, imploring of give this 30 days, check your blood work, check how you look, you know, like take some photos, take some measurements, and if in 30 days of doing this you don't look, feel, and perform better than you ever thought you could, then, you know, obviously there's something wrong, try something else. But what I find again and again is that this stuff works better than pretty much anything that, that folks have ever played with. So that's the book. It started off rather small in the ambition, but it's just grown with time, and I'm getting some really good help with Erich Krauss, who's the publisher for Victory Belt Publishing. They're pretty famous for their mixed martial arts and martial arts instructional books, but I sought him out for some help on this because he had some expertise both in the training and fitness side of things, but also was giving me a lot of latitude to write this exactly the way I wanted it. I was in Professor Cordain's office when he received the original manuscript that he submitted. The publisher returned their rough draft of his material, and it was vastly different than what he had turned in. And it was a very different book in application than what he really wanted it to be. They changed it a lot. And so I feel pretty good that this is going to really represent my voice and my experience and hopefully help a lot of folks. That's definitely my goal.
That's awesome. I've known those tribulations of working with outside media. That's fabulous, Rob. You know, when do you think this might be available for people, and where can they pick it up when they sort of hunt it down?
It's available on pre-order on Amazon.com right now under the Paleo Solution, or they could Google or, you know, a search on there for Rob Wolf. It'll be available everywhere, you know, Barnes & Noble, Borders, local bookstores, September 10th or thereabouts. So it's getting close.
Isn't that awesome? And I'm really happy for you because there's, you know, a few people that I have the respect because, you know, we just tapped in a couple of things about, you know, what you do, and we haven't even touched the performance or the training side, which I just heard some awesome things. So I really appreciate you making the time. But I would be a little bit remiss if I didn't ask you one question. And, you know, people are often surprised how moderate I am about that. You know, do you feel okay just talking for a moment on what's your feelings on CrossFit and what you actually do now at your training center?
Oh, sure. Despite all the stuff that's gone on with CrossFit and, like, I guess you would say, like, animosity or falling out with the admin, the concept, the conceptual framework, I dig. Like, I love it. I think there's some genius that exists in there. The unfortunate thing from my perspective, and this is trying to be as distant and dispassionate about this and, like separate myself and be, like, fully, like, analytical about this. I think that there's so much good stuff there, but there's so much hyperbole and ego that this thing that could be really, really good and good for a variety of people, whether, you know, our aged elderly population or mixed martial arts athletes or, you know, whatever, there's some opportunities there to refine and develop the technology, which people are doing, left, you know, all over the place, but it's not really being embraced by the parent organization. There's this kind of reticence to acknowledge developments and progression within the community, and I think that's a huge loss, and the evolution is actually, it's almost like the parent organization, the HQ organization, is like a stone in the middle of a river, and instead of it being a boat in the river that's you know, going with the flow of this thing and developing and seeing these new places, the developments are happening around them and then bypassing them. You know, people like Michael Rutherford developed the Max Effort Black Box. There are tons of people that are developing different iterations on this theme and also discovering that work capacity for work capacity's sake is not that good of a thing, particularly when it's at the expense of thousands of repetitions of marginal form on various movements like pull-ups and thrusters and push presses that are ingraining some bad movement patterns and also a lot of structural issues for folks down the road. So it's a really good concept. It's got some great meat to it, but then I think you have to be very selective in how you take a bite out of it and apply it into your own program. We still use a lot of the concepts, but, you know, like it's very interesting for me. The movement at large has shifted very much into this focus on what they term elite athletics, or, you know, the fittest man on earth or whatever the hyperbole kind of is. Fascinating deal for me is that in our gym, early on, we developed a stratified buy-in. So we had a beginner's class, and then an elements level one, level two class, and we had skill standards and performance standards to get into these different things. It's very, very similar, like if you did any type of a performance-based martial art, like jiu-jitsu or Thai boxing or something, you would have beginning, intermediate, and advanced, and it makes it easier to coach people and all that sort of stuff. I mean, you know, this is standard stuff in, like, dance or yoga or anything, but it was kind of new and revolutionary for the CrossFit scene. And all that stuff went really well, but something that our beginners were consistently telling us that I did not listen to for a couple of years, they would tell me, I really like this, but I don't like the competition. I don't like the stopwatch. I don't like the competition. It's too hard. And we would, you know, respond to them, oh, you know, just take it easy, take your time, you know, don't worry about that. But there's a reality that if you've got a heart that beats and any, you know, I don't care what age you are, as soon as your name goes on a board and a stopwatch is involved, mm-hmm. you've got competition, you know. Right. And it takes a zen-like distancing from the situation to be able to, say, focus on your technique at the expense of the time that it's taking to do a movement and not look like you totally suck at a workout. And so finally we had this idea, and it was the suggestion of one of our clients that was saying, hey, I don't like the stopwatch deal. And we put together this class that we've called it Low Intensity, and now I think we're playing with some other names on it. Basically, we get in, and it's a coached strength and conditioning class, but we go through various movements that day in a coached format, but nobody's name goes on the board. There's no stopwatch put in, and it is our most popular class by far. Like, it has grown three times faster than all the other classes. And it's very reminiscent to what I know what you do in your practice, because I've talked to Andy Dees. Like, I know there's that connection there, so I know it's very reminiscent to what you historically have done. It reminds me a lot of what Erwin McCour of a Movement Natural does with his stuff, which is a focus on building capacity from functional movement proficiency first. Like, do it right, then do it right again. And then when you can do it right, let's go to a next, you know, a more evolved movement, do it right again, and build capacity and functionality in that regard, instead of just simply, you know, like 500 air squats for time or something like that with marginal form and tons of volume. So that's where I've taken a lot of really interesting ideas out of the CrossFit scene, but I feel like we've definitely gone in a very different direction. And the funny thing is that we'll be painted as pussies in taking this route. We've you know, logged a third place affiliate cup team. We've put people into mixed martial arts championship bouts and stuff like that. So what we do is plenty effective, and I don't want to, like, jump up and down and hoot and holler about that stuff, but it's just important to remember that the more people can focus on progressions and moderation in their coaching, the better results they will get, the more that people will enjoy the process, and the more successful you'll be in a business.
And that sounds like definitely being a pussy.
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing is there's so many of these people who are struggling to live hand to mouth running these gyms, and if they moderated their approach, they would keep all the people who came through the door, and then you just start stratifying things, and your pipe hitting fire breathers that want to, like, kill themselves every day, right on, cool. But that's almost like your MMA fight team. Keep those people away from your general population because they will scare them, you know. And be able to wear multiple hats and appeal to multiple varieties of, you know, personalities and people and needs, you know, meet the person who comes through your door, meet them where they're at, and give them what they need, and then you're going to be successful.
Awesome. I couldn't say it better. I've always said that the biggest thing with CrossFit was them not listening to their own coaches, you know, people like yourself, like Everett, who I have tremendous respect for as coaches. And, you know, it's good to see that you're still – doing some great things. And Rob, I can't, you know, thank you enough for spending the time, because anyone who's listening to this now knows that this information is worth its weight in gold. So thank you again for your time. And people, if you're going to pick up Rob's Paleo Solution, I'm going to pre-order it. You definitely want to go to Amazon.com. And Rob, are you working with Performance Menu anymore?
I do a little bit here and there, but I've been so busy with other stuff, not a ton, but a Performance Menu is awesome. Greg and Amy Everett are family to me, so we're real tight with those guys.
And do you have any upcoming seminars or anything that, you know, people want to learn more? I know people get really passionate about this stuff. Is there any way for people to find out more, or just start with a book?
Yeah, the seminar list is on the robwolf.com website. I think July 31st I'll be in Arlington, Virginia. We're in Denmark in October. We've got a couple other locations bounced around in there, too. We've been really slow in booking other locations because we haven't been 100% sure on the wrap of the book, and then also we have a pretty big marketing campaign for the book that will involve traveling all around the United States, Canada, and Europe, and so we're trying to drop in the Paleo Solution seminars around that other schedule.
Oh, tremendous. I know that's quite an undertaking, so definitely best of luck and much success, Rob. Thank you so much for your time today, and we'll definitely look forward to the book coming out.
Thanks, Josh. Huge honor being here. Thanks a lot.